Hey, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to this week's message. My name's Aaron, and I'm on the staff team here at Eastlake. Everything we do around here depends on the generous donations of our local and online community, people just like you, who tune into these messages and see great benefit from living that idea that life is a gift and love is the point. So if you love what Eastlake is up to, we'd encourage you to contribute by going to eastlakecc.com. With that, let's jump into this week's message.
We're in this series called Road to Resurrection, and last week Ryan kicked it off with a message on this idea of going down the spiritual descent path, this soul work, and today we get to hear from an amazing author, and he has his own therapist practice. He's been a leader of spiritual community. His name is Bruce Sanguin, so I'm going to invite you up here. Bruce, we're so excited to have you share with us today. Let's welcome Bruce.
Thanks, Ben. It's great to be back. I love this place. Amazing leadership, amazing musicians. Wow, you guys are so lucky. If I lived in Seattle, I'd be here every Sunday. So great to be here. But I'm afraid I'm getting a bit of a reputation because your leaders invite me to come and give these talks, and you know, what have I talked about? Trauma and grief, and today, wait for it, death. Next time I come, it's gonna be on taxes. But it's not my fault. You know, as human beings, we have to come to terms with this reality that what's on offer here is a time-limited thing. I mean, we can spend our lives in denial about it, but even if we deny it, sooner or later, death's going to be coming for us, and we're going to have to reconcile ourselves one way or another. The poet Robert Harris said, "You can be a king or a street sweeper, but everybody dances with the grim reaper." So, yeah. We're in the middle of a series of talks here. We're going to end up at Easter, but the thing is, you can't get to Easter without going through Good Friday. I spent almost 30 years in the church presiding at both Good Friday and Easter services, and on Easter Sunday, we were filled to the rafters. Everyone wanted to come out and hear the hallelujahs and how life had defeated death. It's a beautiful thing. Who wouldn't want to be part of that? We stationed bouncers at the doors so death could not get in. We lined the aisles with hundreds of bouquets of lilies so the stench of death was nowhere present. It's how everybody wanted it. Good Friday, on the other hand, with its minor chords and the story of how an indispensable man was unceremoniously dispensed with, was attended by a mere smattering of the faithful. St. Paul asks, "O death, where is thy sting? But if attendance figures are any indication, death still has some sting left in it." So I'm going to share with you this morning a few elements of my own journey with, I guess, coming to terms with death. Have any of you heard of Ray Kurzweil? He's a futurist, and he's an inventor, and pretty amazing guy. But he believes that I'm defeatist in coming to terms with death. When Steve Jobs said that life or death is one of life's greatest change agents, Kurzweil called him a deathist, by which he meant he's just part of the whole religious thing and part of the rationalization of death, where we're trying to come to terms with it, when what we should be doing, says he, is defeating it, conquering it. He says there's going to come a time when we truly will figure out how to be immortal as human beings. Good luck with that one. When I was in seminary, I devoured a book by Ernest Becker called The Denial of Death. I pestered all my colleagues with it. He won a Pulitzer Prize with it, but Ray Kurzweil would call him a deathist too, but Ernest Becker didn't try to rationalize death. In the end, he was actually defeated by it. Becker pointed out that at both ends of the life cycle, at birth and right at the very end when we are dying, death is our constant companion. When we come into this world, the birth process is itself a harrowing journey. We don't believe this because still today in the birth industry, we tell ourselves that the growing embryo and then the baby in the birth process, it doesn't feel anything, is not sentient, but it's actually not true. There are courageous souls out there who, through various forms of regression therapy, holotropic breathwork, psychedelics, hypnotism, actually can go back into their birth and remember it. And what they remember is that they're doing bloody battle. It's the first brush with the possibility that we're not going to make it. And we come into this world with that unconscious fear. So he's saying, right there in the beginning, we're aware of our mortality, but we shove it underground in order to be able to live. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to live with it. It was Becker's observation that then we go on to live our lives, and the entire human civilization, our libraries, our architecture, our philosophies, all our creative projects, our very own lives are what he calls immortality projects. Because we're in flight from this unconscious fear of death. And in the end, for him, everything was rendered insignificant. We alone among all the creatures of earth suffer this awareness of our mortality. My dog, Koa, for example, has not spent a second, I don't think, dealing with anxiety about his mortality. Every day, it's like it's the first day of his life, and he's actually excited to see me in the morning. Humans, on the other hand, were saddled with having to contend with the grim reaper. So you can tell that I'm a lot of fun at a party. Fortunately, my fascination with Becker came to an end. I realized that his book, The Denial of Death, could well have been called The Denial of Life, because he ended up ignoring the incredible creativity of life. He ended up being trapped by it, because either you let it in and you were paralyzed by it, according to him, or you were in denial of it and then you just unconsciously created all these projects which ended up being insignificant anyways because they all died with you. And what he did was he set death as the ultimate context for life. It's kind of like the second law of thermodynamics for those of you who are physics professors out there, where, you know, if you assume that life is a closed energy system and everything is in a process of dissipation and it's irreversible, and I don't know, this might be good science, but it's terrible metaphysics, because all of that creativity, it's assumed, is in the service of death. Why do we do this? Why are there these philosophies of despair? The French existentialists, Camus and Sartre, what Ernest Becker did. My own take on this as a psychotherapist is that if we've experienced failures of love very early in life, we're under-resourced. So that as adults, when we come up against tragedy, or trauma, or evil, or social injustice, we default to a feeling of hopelessness that we had as children. We get bullied about by reality as if there's nothing to be done. We fall into depression or anxiety or despair. For example, the feeling, if we have an unconscious belief that I am unlovable, I am unworthy, this will attract those kinds of philosophies so that we can legitimize our feelings. You know what I mean? We feel unlovable, and then we read something that says, yeah, it's true, it's all going to come to an end. We go, this, see what I mean? There's a good reason for me to be depressed here. And then we interpret everything through that desperate lens. It's futile. Everything's meaningless, purposeless. And then we discover that if we actually do our work and realize that this feeling of hopelessness and despair and meaninglessness and purposelessness is actually a memory of a time when we were helpless to do anything about it, we can emerge out of that depression. It's a memory. It's a memory. Life's not hopeless. So death is no justification for despair. How do we come to terms with it consciously? Is it possible to turn our own mortality into an opportunity for more life? Interesting possibility. The French priest and paleontologist Pierre Teilhard de Chardin said that the evolutionary arrow, the trajectory of life, we're moving in a biased trajectory from what he called bien-être, well-being, to plus-être, more being. So is it possible that the awareness of our mortality can actually issue in more being, more life? I don't know if it's because I'm 62 now, and I have more life behind me than I do ahead of me, but life has been encroaching upon me. I've had some experiences, visions, and dreams in which death is telling me fairly directly, dude, come to terms with it. I'm coming for you. And I'll share with you a poem I wrote about one of those dreams. Here's the poem. The Lord of Death, riding an elephant, tells me to return to my village. The Lord of Death, riding an elephant, tells me to return to my village. The Lord of Life, riding his own elephant, is silent. Speak up, man. They say a dream of riding an elephant is a sign of mastery over one's life. To face death without denial, maybe this is mastery. Death has been intruding lately, its gray, hulking presence shaking the ground beneath my feet as I sip tea looking out the window, marveling at a budding vine, or holding my beloved in the theater, weeping at the thought of leaving her behind one day. It's true. The original elephant in the room is coming for me. The original elephant in the room is coming for me. Big ears waving, feet pounding, trunk swinging, every step real and heavy, inexorable. What's to be done except hitch a ride and ask to be taken to this mysterious village? For the purpose, I presume, to lay my bones down. For the purpose, I presume, to lay my bones down and find those who are willing to honor my memory. Take me home then, but not before my heart has exploded a few more times for love of budding life and my sweet, sweet beloved. The Lord of Death riding an elephant? Come on. Aren't dreams amazing? I mean, this great mystery is living us. I knew nothing. I'd never come across that image before. So I got up in the morning after I had the dream and I Googled Lord of Death riding an elephant. And who knew? There's this cartoon series. It's a series, but have you ever, it's called Hellboy? Have you seen the movie? It's called Help. Sure enough, there was a painting by the artist of the Lord of Death riding an elephant. I was blown away. And the Lord of Death was saying to me, it's time to find your village. Find the land where you're going to bury your bones. Find the people that are going to honor your memory. This is your life task, guy. It's time. And stuff like this is just happening to me lately. I'm sitting there in the theater and I'm holding my wife, Mia. And the movie's about something else completely. And I'm so in love with her that I just start weeping at the realization that one day I'm going to leave her behind. Or I'm sipping tea, and I look out the window, and there's this vine budding, and it's so exquisite. And then once again, I find the tears falling down my face, realizing this isn't going to, I'm not going to last forever to see this. I'm overwhelmed with the beauty and the truth of existence. And it comes to me, it's like, this is real. No, really, this is going to happen. No, really. I mean, it's not intellectual anymore. It's like, this is really coming for you. And then everything, I don't know if you have had this experience, but everything registers just a bit more deeply. Just a bit more deeply. If we'll just feel it. None of this has to be morbid, you see. It scares the crap out of us if it's just an intellectual thing, because we try to do all these mental gymnastics. Well, I'm going to die, but you know. The secret seems to be just stop and feel it. Just feel where it's taken you. Any anxiety, any worry that you've ever had, track it to its source. It's like a river. It's going to flow to death. And then you discover you can actually sit in that feeling. Oh, this is going to come to an end. Oh. And then the tears start coming. And then you look around and say, God, this is beautiful. What an opportunity I've had to be able to experience all of this. I think you told me, Ryan, that you had a tattoo that says, live as if there's no tomorrow.
Love like it's going to end.
Love like it's going to end. Beautiful. It's the awareness of the end that makes you think, I got this one opportunity to love. You and I have this opportunity here this morning. It's fleeting. It's going to go away to connect with each other. Let's feel it, man.
Well, hey everyone, excuse the interruption for a quick minute. My name is Kristen. I'm one of the team members here at Eastlake, and we're so glad that you're joining us today on the podcast. It's been so encouraging for us to hear stories from people all over the country and the world who are listening to these messages and resonating with this idea that we just keep saying over and over again, which is life is a gift and love is the point, and that we are all committed to being a beneficial presence in our own community. So thanks for joining us. I hope that that's resonating with you. It's just really fun for us. So wanted to also say thank you to those of you who contribute. This place, all of these things that we do are happening because of people who make consistent, even just small consistent gifts. It helps us plan. It helps us know that there are really people behind us who want this thing to continue. So thank you to those of you who do that. If you haven't had a chance to give yet, I would encourage you to maybe think about doing that if you find this beneficial in your own life. To make a contribution, it's really easy. You can go to eastlakecc.com and there's a donate button there with all the info. So thanks so much for tuning in. Let's get back to the message.
This is why I'm a psychotherapist now. Psychotherapy is simple. It's just you create a space in which people's hearts can open to the gift and the inherent intensity of life. I like what Joseph Campbell, he's a mythologist, said about people who are searching constantly for the meaning of life. I've been a meaning freak. It's like since I was 20, I was, what's the meaning of life, man? I gotta find a meaning, as if it was hiding under a rock somewhere. Where's the meaning? So he said, people say that what we're all seeking is meaning of life. I don't think that's what we're really seeking. I think that what we're seeking is an experience of being alive, so that our life experiences on the purely physical plane will have resonances with our innermost being and reality. We will actually feel the rapture of being alive. This is where we want to get to. And we're more likely to feel the rapture of being alive when we realize it's all coming to an end. And instead, what do? We close our hearts. We lose our lives in distraction. And again, I think the reason that we do this is we've come to a conclusion that we can't feel our lives and survive. And this is related to early trauma. Because when we experience failures of love then, it was true. There was no way to survive that. There was no way to feel it and survive it, so we shut it down. I can't feel that stuff and live when I'm a little kid. So I close my heart to the feeling. And the problem is, there are many problems with that, but one of the things I discovered about a year ago when I was on this vision quest was I clearly saw what I had done with my life because I refused to feel it. I was neither all in, nor had I exited life. I mean, by exit, I mean, we all get that choice, right? We can leave. So I hung out in this limbo space. I wasn't in, I wasn't out, I was kind of neutral. I was kind of going, well, let's see how this kind of goes here. And sorry. But I wasn't feeling my life. And it's possible to live your whole life in this neutral space where you're not in and you're not out. And it's tragedy. The poet and mystic William Blake captured the secret of this rhythm of feeling life in all its intensity. Grieving because it's coming to an end. Feeling death. Opening to joy. Letting it go because it's all transient. He wrote, he who binds to himself a joy. He who binds to himself a joy does the winged life destroy. But he who kisses the joy as it flies lives in eternity's sunrise. And you can't, this is a practice, this is a life competency. Maybe the key spiritual practice is to learn to kiss the joy as it flies. But you won't do that until you've come to terms with death, to let it go, let it go, let it go. And then we can live in eternity's sunrise. So there's no more important work that we can do than freeing up our hearts, doing our trauma work so that we can feel it all and not shut ourselves down to this holy rhythm. More life, death, grief, then more life. Have any of you seen this 1986 German film? It was called Wings of Desire. It's kind of an arty film, but it's set in East Berlin before the fall of the wall. And there are angels all around Berlin because they've come to comfort these human beings. There's so many of them, and yet they're alienated, and they're all alone and so lonely and disconnected. And so they find subtle ways to intervene and comfort the human beings. But one of these angels falls in love with a woman who works in the circus. She's a trapeze artist. And he makes the decision, against all of his angel friends' recommendation, to give up his wings and his immortality to become human so he can be with her, because he longs to feel her skin He longs to be able to smell the coffee in the morning, the scent of hyacinth and wisteria, to feel the grass beneath his feet, and to have this sensuous experience of being human, which you can't have as angels. And by the time the movie's finished, you're sitting there realizing this mortal existence is a remarkable experience, because we get to sensually feel all of this life. And here's an angel giving up his immortality for the privilege of being able to feel this life deeply. Because that's what we want to do, right? Joseph Campbell was right. We want to feel the intensity, the inherent intensity. And by intensity, what I mean by that is you feel the absolute value of life. And you don't feel the absolute value of life until you realize that it's not permanent. That's intensity. Last time I was with you, I shared an experience I had. I was on a vision quest, not unlike what Brian's recently been on, and I'm sure you've heard about that. But these were two visions that came to me, and they were direct teachings about death. In this vision, a dead Douglas fir, you know, Douglas fir, those huge trees with the corrugated bark, you know, it's like 300 feet, lying on its side on the forest floor, stretched out 50 meters, rises up a coniferous resurrection before me. Except I was to learn that in the forest, nothing is truly dead. The spirit lives on in the giving of life. Sprigs of cedar, salal, mushrooms, and moss living off the offering of her corrugated body. This towering brown spirit curls her finger at me, beckoning me to disappear in her roots and her bark and her body. I guess I could have resisted her allure, but it never occurred to me. In conjugal union, she then lays down with me on the forest floor. There, in her body and soul, she shows me what it feels like to make an offering of one's life. All that is required is a vanishing into the great offering that is the universe. To die, and so to discover in the dignity of dissolution, and so to discover in the dignity of dissolution the ecstasy of Easter. When we see one of those trees lying in the forest floor, we say we think it's dead, right? Well, this Douglas fir came in the vineyard and said, that, dude, I'm not dead. The spirit of this tree was so alive. And it was teaching me that even in death, we are to give life. Even our body is to go back into the earth and give life. And I found out that you can now buy these mycelium suits for death. Mycelium are mushrooms. And you put this on your body when you die, and it hastens the dissolution process so that more life can grow out of you faster. Before I had this vision, I thought that would be morbid, man. I keep those suits away from me. I want to live forever. After this vision, I said, bring it on. Where do you get one of these suits? And as in death, so in life. We're meant to undergo an ego death. And the moment we become less attached to our ego, the less clingy we become, the more life we're able to offer, to give back. The problem is, in the modern age, right, we identify with this body. I am my body. And of course, it's true in one sense. I am this body, and I kind of get attached to it. But it's not all we are. Every religion has known this. In Hinduism, for example, they say we have multiple bodies. Three of them are the physical, they call them koshas. There's the physical body, and there's the mental and vital body, and then there's the causal body. And these last two don't go anywhere. They're non-physical. And in the Christian tradition, you know, there's this big conversation about, well, if Jesus was resurrected, what happened to his body? I mean, they were Jews. They knew that the body decayed. And Paul said, don't be silly. Physical body decays, but the spiritual body rises up. So I'm going to summarize here what the Lord of Death has taught me. First, it's a mistake to pit life against death. They are not enemies. They are not opposites. We shouldn't be talking about the triumph of life over death. Life and death are aspects of the great mystery in time and space. And because life is absolute, death is part of the life cycle, not its opposite. Second, death is the great reminder that we're in control of nothing. Give it up. In accepting this, we surrender our egos and we stop trying to control everybody and everything, including our own life. And eventually what happens, if you go deep into this contemplation, you start to identify with the great mystery that is living us, more than with this local occasion of that great mystery. We are this great mystery, this great cycle that is living us. And you hold on to life with an open hand. We're in control of nothing. So let it live you. Third, as Jesus taught, death to the fear-based ego that's so into survival, death to this ego is the source of life. He said, unless a seed fall into the ground and die, it cannot give life. And when he's talking about the seed, he was talking about the husk, that when it falls away, it releases all the potential. Again, death is not the enemy. It's a portal into abundance. Learning to die both physically and spiritually. Fourth, by denying death, we deny life. We rob ourselves of what I was talking about as intensity. And its intensity is only revealed when we realize that it's fleeting. It's not going to be for here forever. So feel it. I'm not saying hold on to it. Just feel it as it comes through you. Feel the beauty. Feel the love. Feel the mystery. Feel it all. We can do it. It's possible. Five. Life is a rehearsal for death. Death teaches us to let go. We are to shed everything that gets in the way of what really matters. And I'm convinced that what really matters is the heart. And by the time we get to the end of our life, we should be able to say with conviction, I am in my heart. That's where the essence of us lives. It's our heart. And the spiritual practice, therefore, is shedding everything that gets in the way of this realization. Just letting it go, letting it go, letting it go. Until by the time we're ready to die, we're just pure heart. And that's where creation happens, because God is this divine heart out of which all of creation is flowing. And so we become creators when we get this. And this strange teaching, which I'm still coming to terms with, is that there comes a time in your life when it's really time to find where the land that's going to receive your bones. And as I say, I'm not really sure what this means, except for all of a sudden it's very poignant for me. I'm starting to look I'm starting to Google for where I want to die. Like, I'm looking at islands off the coast of Vancouver Island. Suddenly, all of a sudden it matters. Well, is this going to be the land? Are these going to be the people who remember me? Who are my people? And finally, time, not money, is the currency of our lives. And how we spend it is the measure of our life. The Lord of Death approaches with a time-limited offer. And so, because time is the currency of our lives, these are a few questions that I'm left with and I'll leave you with. Who do you choose to spend your time with? You'll have your own answer, but currently my answer is only those who respect me and who respect life. I don't have time to spend with others. Second question. How much more time are you going to spend living someone else's life? The life that society thinks you should live, the life that your family maybe thinks you should live, or that everybody else thinks you should live, but is not really your own life. How much more time are you going to spend doing that? Third, and I'll end here, third question I'm left with. How much time do I want to spend feeling and behaving as if I am unlovable and unworthy? As if I am too much, as if I am not enough. These feelings are the result of being shamed, and they are voracious. They will take up your whole life if you let them. When I went up to receive communion, this beautiful woman looked into my eyes and said, "You are the light of the world." And what I want to leave you here with, folks, is it's true. You, each one of you, is the light of the world. Don't waste any time believing anything else. May it be so. Thank you.